All right, what are we at, 247? Yep.
We're all good, baby. Yeah. How is it? How we looking? Make my mom proud?
Yep.
Yep.
Welcome to episode 5 of Mind the Game with LeBron James and JJ Redick, brought to you by Uninterrupted and 342 Productions. Today's episode is a very special episode. It's a two-part episode. LeBron and I lay the groundwork for the NBA playoffs, what makes them different, what the experience is like as a player going through it. And we are also joined by LeBron James's high school basketball coach, Coach Keith Dambrot. Coach Dambrot coached for 40 years at the college and high school level. He was the head coach at Central Michigan, Akron, and of course, his latest stop, Duquesne, where they made the NCAA tournament and won their first round game. Coach Dambrot is now retiring. Just a fascinating conversation we have with him. Again, this show is about basketball, and we are going to cover all aspects of basketball, including college, high school, youth development, FIBA, the WNBA. I know we spoke at length last week about the icons in women's college basketball. So awesome to get Coach Keith Dambrot's experience, expertise, and insight through his lens. And of course, through his lens, what it was like to coach a freshman and sophomore LeBron James in high school. There are a few different concepts that we talk about in episode 5. Perhaps most importantly is something called top locking. And I want to be very clear on this because there tends to be some confusion, particularly from Jason Gallagher. It is not top blocking. It is top locking. Top locking is an off-the-ball defensive scheme where you force the shooter, the offensive player, coming off of a wide pin down or at any sort of off-ball screen, and you force him towards the basket. You get on his high side or his top side, and you force him back towards the basket or the baseline. All right, let's say the ball is right here. Defender there. Let's say there is a shooter in the corner. And there is a big guy that's going to screen away for the shooter. As he comes down to screen, this big would drop to protect the basket. And a top lock is simply when the shooter's man gets all the way on the outside, forcing him back towards the basket. The protection, again, comes from this big or whoever is guarding the screener who drops back. Again, top locking. Not top blocking. Oh, real quick on the top blocking thing, which again, this is a little bit of a cheat code for the Boston Celtics. Let's say that this is Kristaps Porzingis, and let's say this is Jaylen Brown. At any point in time, if Kristaps Porzingis goes to set an away screen on Jaylen Brown, and Jaylen Brown's defender gets into a top lock, and Kristaps Porzingis' defender drops back to provide support, Jaylen Brown can just go set a screen right here, and you've got Kristaps Porzingis popping into space for an open three. That's sort of the counter if you have a shooting big. Also, similar to top locking, another concept that it comes up in the conversation is icing or downing. Icing or downing a pick and roll is when the defender guarding a ball handler on a side pick and roll gets, again, on the high side or the top side and forces it towards the baseline. The big man who is covering the screener drops back towards the baseline, towards the basket, to give support to the defender on the ball handler. Again, the defender on the ball handler has completely opened up, gotten on the ball handler's top side, and is forcing the ball down towards the baseline. We've got two offensive players here. The screener goes into a pick and roll over here on the side of the court. As that's happening, the big defender would shout ice or downs. Again, some teams have color concepts for this, but ice or down, he would then drop to provide support. And the guy guarding the ball would jump on the high side of the offensive player, of the ball handler, and force it down towards the baseline. That is an ice or down. Motion offense is simply a five-man offensive scheme that relies on screening action, ball movement, and body movement. Motion offense typically is very free-flowing. There's not a set action that leads to another action. At least that's how I was taught it. Motion offense just means you're running pin downs, away screens, you're moving the ball side to side. Again, you're just in motion. You know how I was taught motion offense was three out, two in. So three offensive players outside the three-point line and two offensive players inside the three-point line. And again, motion offense could be any one of these options. You pass to the wing and you go screen away and replace. As that's happening, maybe you get a cross screen here and you replace. Let's say none of that works. Ball was over here on the right side. Ball goes back to the top of the key. Again, motion offense. Let's say you can run a pin down here, run a pin down here. That's just motion offense. Is ball, body movement, pin downs, away screens, cross screens, motion offense. Flex offense is another offense we talk about. Flex offense, very simply, is a half-court offensive scheme that relies on a baseline screen and then a pin down. And that is a continuous offense. A lot of high school teams run it. College teams still run it. Remember Boston College when we played them and I was at Duke? Coach Al Skinner, that is literally all they ran offensively, was the flex offense. Gary Williams in Maryland also ran the flex offense a ton. This is just a basic flex offense. So you'll have five offensive players. And a lot of times a ball handler will enter it this way. He would pass to one of the men up top and make some sort of cut off the other high guy. Once that happens, we are in a flex alignment. And this, all it is a baseline screen looking for a layup into a pin down. And again, once you pin down, you go back out to the corner. Again, this can be continuous. Baseline cut, pin down. Some teams that still run this, once this first pin down happens, a lot of times this is a big, this is a guard. He would then just come back and set a high pick and roll, and you play out of that. So you can run flex to get into other actions, or you can make flex continuous. As always, thank you for listening and watching the Mind the Game podcast with LeBron James and JJ Redick. If you haven't already, please hit that subscribe button. Go follow us on whatever audio platform you listen to us on. Thank you for all of the support. Thank you for all the feedback. Thank you for all the discussion points. And my new favorite thing, from Mind the Game podcast is when I'm watching a game and I happen to be on my Twitter account and one of you guys points out a slot cut. One of you guys points out one of the actions we talk about on the podcast. Pretty awesome for us. So appreciate y'all. And this is episode 5 of Mind the Game.
End game, game 2, one of your most iconic shots.
What game?
Game 2, 2009 conference finals.
Oh, yeah.
Over Orlando. Yeah. I have a question about that play, because that is an example of a, you know, off ball movement, catch and shoot three.
Yep.
So if I remember correctly, Mo was taking it out.
Yep.
Delonte set like a flare screen for Ilgauskas.
Yep.
Right here. I think it was Pavlovich just kind of ran to the ball.
Yep.
And you were over here on this elbow. You actually never got a screen on that play.
No, because I was supposed to, the play was for to fake up and go backdoor for the lob. And Turk played it, and Turk played it perfectly.
Okay.
So I faked up and I tried to go back for the lob and I said, it's not open. It's not open. So I just came to the ball.
And Turk fucked that up.
Yeah.
My only issue on that play.
I didn't even see Rashard. He had a hell of a contest.
Yes.
He was guarding the ball.
He was guarding Mo, yeah.
Yeah, he was guarding the ball. I didn't see until after the fact. I never saw him.
But you only saw Turk.
I only saw Turk.
Do you remember your first playoff game?
My first playoff game, I do.
What do you remember about it?
I was nervous as fuck. That's what I remember.
This was third year.
Yeah, and I don't know. I mean, we can look it up and figure out when was the last time the Cavs were in the postseason. But that was just like my first year, okay, I was like establishing myself in my first year. Second year, we missed the playoffs by maybe one or two games. And it's like, okay, I'm here to like play ball, but I want to make the next step. I got to get this franchise to the postseason. And my third year, we finally made the postseason, and our first game was against Washington at home. I was nervous as hell. My stomach was hurting all goddamn long, all day until the ball jumped.
Why do you think? Like, what have you reflected on that? Why do you think you were more nervous for that game than any other game?
Well, it's two games. My first ever game in Sacramento, and then I didn't want to fucking lay an egg.
I think
everybody was watching.
This is not a narrative podcast. I just want to be clear on this. But I think what you're admitting here is that you felt the burden. You felt the pressure.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Pressure. Who's under more pressure?
Yeah, who is it? What's pressure? What is pressure? No, I didn't want to lay an egg, man. I was, 20 years old. Got the team to the postseason. I didn't want to go out there and shit the bed. I was maybe 21, maybe. But like, I didn't want to shit the bed. First playoff game, you know, look out there, there's Gilbert Arenas and Antoine Jameson and Caron Butler and those guys. They were playing great ball that year. We're inexperienced as hell. I didn't want to lay an egg.
What'd you have?
32-11-11. I laid an egg, all right.
Oh, man.
In their locker room.
I think don't quote me on this. I think it was like 35-7-6 or 35-7-7 or something.
Well, for the whole series?
For the whole series. Yeah.
Oh, shit.
Not bad.
No, not bad. Not bad for the first one.
You've played in a ton of playoff games, obviously. You've won championships.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot that's different about the playoffs in the regular season. What is it? What is different about the playoffs?
In general or for me?
In general.
In general.
We'll get to you specifically.
In general, as you know, as you've played in a lot of postseason games too, one possession can lose you the series. And compared to the regular season, you can get away with some slippage. You can get away, it's 4 or 5 nights, fucking tired. You know, it's a cold-ass Tuesday night in Milwaukee. You know, you're like, holy shit. Not this Milwaukee team, I mean. Obviously, you get up for those guys, but in the postseason, one bad stretch. It could be a fucking 6-0 run. It could be a turnover here. It could be you didn't top lock JJ when we told you we top locking him all series. And now he didn't see one go in. Even if there's times like where you could win a playoff game, and because the way you finished the game, you already lost the second one.
Mm.
You'd let that fucking guy or that person get into a rhythm in the fourth quarter because you decided you didn't want to lock in for 8 to 9 more minutes. And yes, we won the game. But now we may lose the war.
Yeah. The mental side of the playoffs, by the way.
Thank you. Yeah.
Particularly against a really good opponent.
Yeah.
I think it was in episode one you said, the further you go into playoffs to win, you have to be a high IQ team.
Yep.
It's obviously emotionally draining.
Mm-hmm.
Because of there is pressure. It's different. you feel more with each win and loss.
Mm-hmm.
You get to two losses in a series. You get mm-hmm. to three losses mm-hmm. in a series, an elimination game. It's you're down 3-2. You've got to go on the road to San Antonio. They won the championship last year. You've got to muster up enough yeah. to beat them to get back home.
Yep.
That emotional toll is a lot. The physical toll, of course, playing.
But right,
to
right.
me, like the mental side of it, I think that is a huge separator because oftentimes mental mistakes within a game can lead to a series loss.
For sure.
I think about one I made. I was in Orlando. We were playing in the conference finals against Boston, and I had played a good game. And there was a timeout. Let's say there was 29 seconds. There was a 5 or 6 second difference between shot clock mm-hmm. and game clock. And go to the timeout. I know we have a timeout. I know we have a timeout. We get the stop. I get the rebound.
You dribble.
First I looked at Stan.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying it was his fault.
Right.
I knew there was a timeout.
Mm-hmm.
I should have called a timeout. And I looked at him
and
he didn't do anything. So then I just instinctively put the ball on the floor and then he called a timeout.
Yeah, and now you can't advance the ball.
So now we got 3 seconds and we've got to take it out three quarter court opposite
yep.
foul line.
Yep.
And we didn't get a good shot off.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we were down.
Yep.
I don't know that we
right.
win anyways, but that's an example
right,
of
right,
like
right,
a
right,
mental
right.
mistake.
Yeah.
I'll give you another one. And this one has bothered me for 4 years. And I'm not throwing this guy under the bus because I think his intention was right. 2020 playoffs, conference finals, you guys are up 1-0 on Denver. And you're down at the end of the game. You've got the ball underneath the basket.
Yep.
Mason Plumlee checks in the game
yep.
to guard Anthony Davis.
Yep.
You are on the left elbow. Anthony Davis is on the right elbow. Danny Green makes some cut or whatever. And Anthony Davis runs to the left wing. You never set a pick. In fact, your back was turned to Anthony Davis and Mason Plumlee.
Correct. Because I was just looking at Doe, like, give me the ball.
I know. And Mason Plumlee point switched.
Yeah, he point switched.
And Anthony Davis hit the game-winning three.
Yeah.
Now you're down 2-0. Like, that stuff, the little tiny plays. It's weird because in the playoffs, I would say the little plays get amplified more. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Versus a regular season, you go through 82 games. It doesn't feel the same way.
Yeah. That's why my body language is so bad throughout the regular season. Because I'm trying to gear them up for the postseason. Because don't understand. Some guys don't understand. Like, it's one play. Like you're saying, one play can be the difference between your ass going home and going to Cabo or Cancun or wherever the hell you're going. Or going to Disneyland or Disney World with the trophy in your hand.
Do you think the sort of game within the game of coaches is different?
Meaning?
Like, but I don't know, Bob Myers maybe didn't originate this, but I know that he said it at some point. There are 82 game players and then there's 16 game players, right? Do you think that in some ways there are regular season, like good regular season coaches versus good playoff coaches? Like how much does coaching matter in the NBA in the playoffs?
That matters a lot. Preparation. Prep. How much prep are you getting going into a series to win? You get out there and you're kind of ready for, you know, everything that's going to be thrown at you. And obviously everybody makes adjustments and then you got the great yeah. players that don't matter what type of fucking game plan you got on them. They're going to exploit it no matter what. But as much as you can be prepared going out for a series. And you know, it changes. You know, that game one is kind of like the filler game, you know. You almost like tell your players, just go out and just fucking play. Like, just go out and play game one. Don't think too much, because if you start thinking too much, now you can't even just like be, you can't even just be a player no more, because now you're just trying to think the game. But me personally, I want overload.
You want overload?
I want overload. I want all the information, everything, everybody, every individual, every pros and con, and I don't do that throughout the 82 game regular season. I don't have the time to do that. I don't have the time.
The league has changed a lot with practice time, shoot around time, amount of time you spend in the film room. It just has.
Yeah, it has.
And You know, I was fortunate. I would say fortunate. 5 of my first 6 years, I played for Stan. I also played for him my last year in New Orleans. When you talk about the preparation, it was interesting to me that he prepared for a regular season game the same way he prepared for a postseason game.
Yeah.
So we're in shoot around for an hour and a half. We got knee pads on. We're going live. I remember at the end of shoot arounds, he'd be like, all right, these guys haven't run this play in 5 games. This is an ATO, but they haven't run it in 5 games. But just, I want to be prepared for it. Let's go through it. Oh, you guys didn't do it right. Let's go through it again.
That's
right?
The Rouse tree.
100%.
That's the Rouse tree. Spo was the same way.
So when we got, but my point is, when we got to the playoffs, it didn't feel any different.
Right, because
when
was
we
already
were prepping
prepared.
For a playoff.
Yeah, for sure.
Game.
That's the Spo was the same way. That's the Rouse tree. You know, you come from that Pat Riley tree. That's just, you prepare every day like it's your last, for sure.
You mentioned the word exploitation again. How much mental energy in a playoff series, playoff game, are you spending on exploitation? How to exploit the other team? You personally.
48 minutes.
Yeah.
And if we need 53 or 58, the whole game. How can you, because I'm trying to generate easy buckets, and I want to get my guys in a rhythm. And how can we exploit the matchups and the players that's on the floor? Sometimes I get a little disrespectful to it as well. If certain guys come on the floor, I'll say it right on the free throw line while we're shooting a free throw, they're shooting a free throw. Yo, we putting him into action. Thumb down him.
Yeah.
I want him to know that, like, you know, we going at him in the postseason.
I'm glad I never played against you in the postseason. Well, I guess I did. Nine minutes in game two
in
2009. I think the other thing for me in playing and in watching is, can you create good offense down the stretch? That's true, of course, in any basketball game.
Yeah.
I think it's harder and harder the further you go in the playoffs.
Yeah, it is. I mean, obviously, the the IQ, which I always come to, the IQ from the coaches to the players heighten and get better as you go on and on and on and on. And once the players get better, too, as well, I feel like being able to execute, certain guys are able to execute better than others and teams or whatever the case may be, because nothing bothers them in the pressure moments. Sometimes the lights are too bright for certain individuals.
And I would say this, though. Here's the thing. It's a fair point. I'm not disagreeing. For my career, I think I shot 41% in the regular season from 3. For my career in the playoffs, I think I shot over 37%.
Yeah, but that's not because of the pressure.
No. But hold on. Oftentimes, our opinion on things are shaped by our own experience. Is that fair?
That's fair.
You and I have had different experiences as basketball players.
Let me hear your
right?
experience.
So later on in my career, once I got to LA and was like a starter and third or fourth option on offense, you get to the playoffs, they treat you like a first option.
Yeah, for sure.
Do you know what I mean by that?
Yeah,
like
they've
come up with a very specific game plan. The same team for game 1, game 2, game 3, through game 7.
Yep.
They've come up with a specific game plan for you. So Utah Jazz 2017, we are going to top lock him as soon as he crosses half court. I mean, Doc Rivers said to me after game 1, he said, "This is not your series. I need you to stand in the corner." Right? I had a terrible series. It was the worst series of my fuck in my like playing career of when I was like actually a player, not like a bench guy, but like it was the worst series of my career. But he's like, "You got to go stand in the corner. We're playing 4-on-4 without you." I'm like, "All right." Right? The closeouts. So if I do create separation or if you do make a mistake in the kick, the closeouts are different in the playoffs.
Yes.
So my catch and shoot time to get a clean release is different. I'm not making excuses. No, I'm just telling you
it is the truth
what I experienced.
So do you think because of that.
By the way, 37% is not horrible.
No, hell no.
It's not good. It's not good for me.
I mean, for you, it's not.
It's terrible. For
you,
it's terrible.
That's terrible for you. Yeah, it's terrible for you.
It's terrible.
I mean, for the average guy,
I'm embarrassed.
They will fucking.
I'm embarrassed.
They might get a max contract over that. But for you, you should, yeah. But that's why I believe certain guys want the postseason start, because they've been guarded a certain way for, what, September to mid-April? A certain way. You know, you have certain games that gets, you know, circled on the calendar that certain coaches get up for, certain players get up for. But at the end of the day, you've been guarded a certain way. And then in the postseason, like you said, the closeouts are different. The preparation is different. Guys are, they're not allowing you to do what you do best, because at the end of the day, if certain guys get off on a team, you're definitely going to lose. If I'm playing the Clippers, you got to deal with Blake and his points in the paint and his roles and his pocket passes from CP. You got to deal with CP. You got to deal with Jamal coming off the bench and doing what he does off the bench. If we allow JJ to get 5 or 6 threes, the series is over. Fuck making 5 or 6 threes. If JJ's shooting 5 or 6 threes, we're going to lose.
Yeah. The Spurs series in 15, I remember, dude, we come out game one, we're in LA, we've got the 3 seed, they got the 6 seed, even though we had the same amount of wins. And Kawhi's guarding me. And I'm like,
you're like, what did I do to deserve this? Why are you guarding me?
And for, I don't remember, maybe the first 4 or 5 games of the season, he started on me. Danny started on CP. Right. Then they switched that in game 6. I think it was game 7, Danny was on me. And at the end of the series, we win. And like, I didn't have a great series, but I had big moments in the series. You know, and at the end of the series, Chip England came up to me. He was like, man, our entire thing was like, we can't allow you to get off.
See, I wasn't even a part of that.
We threw the kitchen sink to you.
Yeah, I wasn't even a part of that. I've seen Pop in the postseason. I've played against him multiple times in finals appearances. There was one time where he called a timeout with like 11 minutes and 52 seconds left in the first quarter. Because a guy on our team got off a 3.
Yeah.
I don't even know if they made the damn 3. But he called a timeout right away. Got on Danny Green. What the fuck? Danny Green got on his ass, took him out, brought him back in. But obviously they had something in place and then they executed.
Yeah. Two last things, points I want to make on the playoff. Or one last point, and then I want to actually get your perspective on something. I think what's different about the playoffs. So, to your point about still winning a game, but maybe an adjustment's made late in the game.
Yep, yep.
And you say, we won the game, but they may have figured something out,
yep.
Right? I think what's different is if you make that adjustment with 6 minutes to go in the third quarter and you come back, still lose the game, the next night you might be playing Memphis. The next night you might be playing Oklahoma City. The next night you might be playing Portland.
Right.
So you might have to wait 2 months.
Right.
In the playoffs, you make an adjustment, you feel like you can exploit something, it's the same damn team.
Same damn
the next
team,
night or
the same
a
personnel.
Day later.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. You figure.
And so that's where you see like Dallas in 11. You remember JJ Barea against the Lakers.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, they JJ and Dirk can pick and roll. They can't stop that.
Yep.
We're just gonna exploit that over and over.
Yep.
What's your perspective on luck in the playoffs?
Need it.
Give me an example.
The biggest example of like luck in the postseason?
In your experience.
Oh, in my experience. Trying to think of my championship runs. I mean, I was on the team. That's the luck, right? I mean, I can't think off the top of my head. But no, seriously, like, you know, you could be a great team, but you need a little luck. You need the ball to bounce your way sometimes. You know, you need a certain player on the opposing team getting foul trouble. You know, it's just, I don't know. I mean, off the top of my head, I started to think of like, what unfortunately what happened with Kawhi with the Zaza Pachulia thing. You know, the Spurs was...
They were good.
Yeah. They were fucking good.
Yeah.
And they were handling the shit out of Golden State up until that point. I think they were maybe up... I don't know off the top of my head. We can always look it up, obviously. Yeah. They were up 17,
yeah.
You know, and they were very fucking good. And, you know, you get Kawhi go down with the ankle, and it's like, oh, shit, the whole thing changes. It's, you know, like, I don't know off the top of my head as far as, you know, my experience, but luck, I want to say it's always unique. Yes, you need it. You need some luck, for sure. You definitely do.
I think it goes back to where we kind of started this with the one play. Where a lucky bounce, an unlucky bounce, a call, a guy reacting to something, 2016.
Yeah.
An injury, right? A play, a moment, right?
Yeah, for sure.
And it's not, I think luck maybe is the wrong word.
It's
but
not,
it's
though.
Like an inflection point almost of like someone gets hurt.
That can change
shot.
The trajectory.
Yes.
The trajectory of what's to come. Yeah. I mean, you look at, what is it, the 0-1 Lakers-Kings? I think that was game 5 or 6, maybe. And they get the tip out to Big Shot Bob.
Yeah.
Like,
everyone, I think Kobe missed a floater over Doug Christie, I think.
And then Shaq gets and yeah, it gets yeah, a tip
yeah,
out.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah,
Vlade, driving. Vlade
yeah, exactly.
It
tipped it out.
Right like, to Big, yeah, right to Robert Horry.
Like, if you clean glass on that, that's the game.
Yeah.
And it, like, how many times a ball gets batted right into one of the biggest clutch players in NBA history at the top of the key, and he just, at the end of the game, bang, bang.
Yeah.
That's some luck.
There's some luck to that.
There's some luck to that.
Complete transparency. We actually got up and sat back down because we had to say this. Game 6.
I don't know how I forgot
Ray
about that.
Allen's 3.
Yeah, I don't.
The sequence of events here.
Yeah. Yep.
That led up to that.
Yep. I mean, the first thing that comes to my mind is that, you know, Pop had took Timmy D out.
Yeah.
You know, and I think because, you know, they could probably was looking to switch everything because we needed threes. We needed threes. So everything was going to be on the perimeter. I had literally just made 1 3 before that. And we ran one of our plays that we've been practicing all year where I would, you know, come and set the pick. Like, we just kind of like we drew up on a whiteboard. I would flare over the top and then come back. And I missed that one. And who knows if Timmy D's on the floor? Does he clean glass? He's cleaned glass a lot in his career. But Bosch is able to, you know, get the rebound over Manu. Manu kind of falls down a little bit. He's kind of on the back. He cleans glass. And then Ray backpedals. Doesn't even look at the line. What if he steps on the line? Backpedaling. What if he steps on the baseline?
What if his toe's on the line?
What if his toe's on the line? There's a lot of preparation because I watch Ray do that every day, like that, but I believe there's some luck to that too.
The thing I always think about that play, and this is going to sound weird and it's going to make me look bad. It will, but I will take it. Manu was such a fucking psychotic competitor. I think about him going for that rebound. If I was in that situation and saw the ball bounce, and this is not revisionist history, I'm just being honest with you, and I'm guarding Ray Allen, I'm staying at home. But Manu is Manu.
He wants that rebound to close the game.
He wanted to tip it out.
Yep.
He wanted to close the game out, win a championship.
Yep.
Like, I'm not knocking what he did.
No, no, for sure, yeah.
And had he not fallen, it wouldn't even have mattered.
Right.
But he's such a competitor, he mm-hmm. went for it. And he fell.
He failed.
And that was all that Ray needed.
That's all he needed. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, wow, wow.
I'm soft.
Thanks, Manu.
Do I get to sit behind the wine?
No, we're going to move it. We're going to move it over here.
That's a big sacrifice.
Do you want to handle this?
I've never met this guy in my life, so I don't even, first guest on our show. I don't even know. No, this is my guy, fucking Coach Keith Danbrot, man. My high school coach really taught me a lot about how to prep for the game, how to play the game. And shit, I wouldn't be here in this seat right now where I am in my career without him. That's for damn sure. That's for damn sure. He's gonna say the same thing about vice versa, no, but like, he literally like taught me how to take the game serious. Like seriously, like every day at practice, how to prep, how to prepare. Like, you know, me and Maverick always talk about like our games were so easy because we practiced so fucking hard. He was like, this is gonna be the hardest thing y'all do on this practice court. When we get into games, it's gonna be easy. And as a player, you don't really believe that shit. When you're 14, 15 years old, you're like, I'm fucking dying out here, man. What are you talking about? The game's gonna be easier. Like the competition, these guys, all these. And he was absolutely right. So I learned how to, what I learned from him was how to really prepare for the games before the games ever took place.
What was LeBron like when you coached him? You had him freshman and sophomore year?
I had him as freshman and sophomore. Yeah. I met him, I think, when he was about 13 and a half, maybe.
Yeah.
He was one of the easiest guys I've ever coached. And so I was a college coach prior to coaching him. And once I saw him, I called some of my friends and I said, you know, I got a guy that I think is one of the best I've seen. And they all kind of laughed at me and they say, oh, you sound like a high school coach now. You know how the high school coach always hypes guys up sometimes, but just easy guy, great teammate, cared about, you know, playing as a team, loved his teammates, played hard. But the biggest thing that jumps out at you is just his innate ability and his ability to learn.
Interesting. You used the word innate in the first episode. Yeah. I thought you were full of shit. I'm glad somebody co-signed it.
Yeah.
When you teach basketball, you just retired. Congratulations.
Congrats. Thank you. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Congrats on that. Hell
got,
of a career.
You got a win in the tourney.
Yes, sir.
When you teach basketball, is there a difference in approach between teaching high school kids or college kids?
That's a great question. So I had always been a college coach. So when I had that group, I treated them like college players. And they actually had the brains of above that. And then once I knew LeBron was going to be a pro, because I had had three NBA guys before him, then I started to treat him like he had to guard Kobe in 4 years. So that's really how I treated him. I treated him like a pro.
That's interesting. Did you feel that?
No.
Did you not know any different?
No. I didn't know no difference. I mean, I'm just going out there and just like, I'm gonna just bust my ass and this is the guy he's the head coach. So whatever he says, let's do it. Like, and like we all came together, like me and my high school boys, you know, we all came to St. V for a reason. And we wanted to win. We wanted to win a state championship. We wanted to win, you know, Maverick was doing, you know, recruiting before he was supposed to be doing it and shit, recruited me to St. V. But yeah, I just wanted to win. So like, you know, there was times where you'd be pissed off at him because you're not used to it. You're not used to, you know, this type of hard work. It's something different. You know, remember I was telling you in episode one how different it is going from, you know, just from grade school to middle school, you know, the intimidation factor of even just walking down the hallways and then going from middle school to high school is even more intimidating. Now you're like being around kids with like beards and like people are driving to school. Like I'm a freshman in high school. I'm riding my bike or one of the coaches picked me up, whatever the case may be. So, you know, it was a super duper different in a sense of anything else I had been up to that point by playing a game of basketball.
How long did you coach total between high school and college?
Well, I had a little sabbatical, so let me think about that. So I was 7 years at Duquesne, 13 at Akron as a head coach, and then 3 other years as an assistant, so close to 35 years.
How do you coach a player that can't remember after timeout plays? Coming out of a timeout. Coming out of a timeout, you draw up a play, and a player habitually forgets what he's supposed to do. As a coach, how do you coach that player?
That's funny because we were just talking about that last night.
Have got some intel on that.
So really what you do is you have an assistant coach that is assigned to that guy. And after you draw up the play, he redraws it up and then tells him again about it. Because there's nothing more frustrating as a coach and even as a player than somebody butchering up plays when you draw it up for them.
LeBron knows this. I coach my son's travel team. It's a fourth grade travel team, 9 and 10 year olds. And there's not a ton of like opportunities
for ATL
call timeout. Yeah, like I'll drop the first play. If we have the ball at halftime, I'll drop it up. I think each team is allowed like 3 timeouts. And you know, if there's opportunities, I'll draw it up. We have the ball. Because a lot of times if we score on another team, they call a timeout.
You don't have
chaos is going to ensue at the change of possession, right?
Yeah.
So it's just like, but it's interesting because I have to deal with that, right? And the one thing I've learned this season, because my second year doing it, is I tell the kids, not every kid, but I tell the kids that need to hear this, just watch what you're supposed to do. There's a lot of stuff happening. Just watch what you're supposed to do.
That's a good point. It's really good.
I think the hardest thing, and this is where I'm curious for both of you, coaching it and having coaches do this, ATOs are such a very specific thing.
Mm-hmm.
And a big part of running an ATO correctly is timing. And so practicing ATOs, like did you practice your ATOs? Did you have a list of certain plays that were ATOs that were outside of your normal sets or concepts? And have you had coaches that actually practiced ATOs?
So I know a lot of coaches do that. But I'm kind of a coach that plays off the feel of the game. So I'll usually run one of the sets that I think is going to go at that particular time. That way you're not as limited as to what you can run at a certain time.
Right.
But obviously we've practiced all of those. And we probably spent more time this year, for instance, just on 5-on-0, just making sure our guys knew every little aspect of it. And you make a great point. You can run a great set, but if you don't execute the screen or the cut or understand how to bump a screen or go tight off of a screen, none of it really matters.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think what you were saying, Jay, I think there's a practicing some ATOs is very beneficial to certain teams. But also as a player, sometimes when a coach comes to the timeout and draws something that you haven't seen before, you kind of get like, oh shit, I ain't seen this one before. I'm gonna execute this one to a T because if it works now, we might can bring this back again. Like, I wanna like, you know, as a player, you feel good about that. Like, oh, I didn't know you had that one in your bag, coach. So like, yeah, you know, you have certain things that, you know, you have a fourth quarter package, you know, you have a, you know, ATO, you have, you know, SOBs, BOBs that you don't wanna run throughout the course of the game. So, because if it's a close game, you wanna try to catch the defense, you know, sleep in or catch them off guard or whatever the case may be. But and the conversation that we're having throughout the course of a game, you want to kind of have things that's in place that you've kind of practiced just so guys have some type of mental, you know, knowledge of, okay, this is what we worked on yesterday or this is what we worked on in shoot around. But it doesn't always happen like that because, you know, coaches and players, like you want to do shit that you want to be able to make in-game adjustments that maybe you didn't have an opportunity to prepare for that earlier that morning, or maybe it is a back-to-back and you didn't really have shoot around. You didn't have an opportunity to, you know, really put in, you know, all the stuff that you may have wanted to put in if you had a practice day. So I think it's all situational.
Yeah. The reason I bring up the timing thing is because there are certain parts of after timeout plays.
Very important.
When you cut.
Yeah, for sure.
When you set the screen.
Absolutely.
Like a big part of ATOs is misdirection.
Yeah, for sure.
Right? And so when that misdirection is occurring, that's important.
Yeah, for sure.
Right? The other reason I ask is because, you know, I Doc was great with this and Brett Brown was great with this, is end of game need plays.
Yeah.
So we had need two plays.
Need three
plays.
Yeah.
And we would have a package. And by the way, that package would change throughout the season.
Yep.
So if we ran a play a couple times in a need three situation.
And it didn't work or whatever.
We'd have to disguise it.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we'd have to practice
for sure.
Right?
Yeah.
And you mentioned something really good, I think. You know, obviously we can't advance the ball in college.
Yes.
So I do think some of your side outs can be plays that you run from a normal set so that guys can actually do the same thing. And then the ability to save plays for late in the game too.
Yeah.
Like I always try to save 3 or 4 that I like to run late that I haven't run the whole game. Or like you said, maybe put them in a closet for 2 or 3 weeks and then bring them back 2 or 3 weeks later. I like to do that as well.
Based on the guys that you have coached throughout your career, what are the skills that translate and transfer from high school to college to the NBA?
Well, I think, you know, there's a lot of guys that have talent, but there's a lot of guys that don't have a good enough brain to play in the NBA. You know, you have to understand the game. You have to understand, you know, what it takes to make the league. For instance, we had the Thomas twins who LeBron knows, that played for us at Eastern Michigan. One of nine twins that played in the NBA, free agent guys. Charles never averaged more than 11 points a game at college, but he had a skill set good enough to be able to play defense, be able to handle the ball enough, and shoot the three ball enough to play in the league. And I think a lot of guys think they have to score to play in the league, but you have to be able to guard to play in the league. You have to be able to play a role. You have to be a good role player, because there's not many guys like LeBron. Most of the guys in the NBA, and you guys know way more than me, are role players. So you have to be really good at something.
Thanks.
I think you were a little more than a role player. No,
absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. You got a clip that I sent your ass the other day.
Yeah, exactly. I would argue everybody's a role player.
That's true.
His role is just to be the guy, right? Luka's role is to be the guy. That's his role. There's a difference between definition and connotation, right? The connotation of a role player. Most 19 and 20-year-olds don't want to hear that.
Right.
I'm going to be a role player in the league, right? And that to me is a struggle. And it's interesting you bring up the brain, because I think part of the brain and part of, curious to get your thoughts on this too, part of lasting in the NBA, skill set, talent, size, strength, all that stuff, super important. Basketball intelligence, super important. What about emotional intelligence? What about being able to be a part of a group, be a part of a team, navigate locker room situations, navigate relationships with coaches, mm-hmm. navigate relationships in the training room? I think to some degree, that's maybe not equally as important.
Yeah.
Because you need all the stuff beforehand, but to last in the NBA, you have to have a level of that.
I mean, it goes back to the saying that I told you about. One of my good friends, Jimmy Iovine, always talks about when the shit gets bigger than the cat, you get rid of the fucking cat. And what he's saying, basically in basketball terms, is a lot of players, when they're at their peak of performance, but on the side that you're talking about, they haven't respected authority. They haven't come in and just wanted to be a part of the group. You know, but they was averaging 25, 30, or whatever the case may be, and they were the shit. When that stuff starts to dwindle, and the shit is not as good as the individual anymore, they get rid of the cat. And we see it in our sport. You see it in sports in general. You know, you have to play the game to play the game as well. And at the end of the day, being a good person shouldn't have to just be dedicated to just sports. That's fucking life.
Yeah.
Just being a good fucking person. Hey, how you doing? Good morning. Okay. Am I having a bad day? Okay, I might be having a bad day. All right. Yo, you all right? Like, shit, like just normal shit. Like, if I'm walking to a door and a woman is beside me, no matter if she's a stranger or not, she's an older woman or younger, like, hold the fucking door open for her. Why? I don't understand. Why is that such a, like, that should be easy. That should be easy, but it's not.
Not everybody does. I had vets my rookie year that were like, dude, you're coming into the practice facility. When you walk in a room, say hi to everybody. Acknowledge people, right? I was in my shit. I wasn't playing. You know, I was
right.
upset.
And you have to take that into account
no,
as well.
No.
But at the end
and
of the day, there is
22. I was young, but like.
I think that helps you last longer in a department that you want to be a part of, because you just play the game a little bit. And no one's telling you to be fake.
No, it's not that.
It's not being fake, it's just being human. Like be a fucking human being. Man, no matter what else, whatever you do.
That's a fine line between being in the league and not being in the league, right? So when you go 12 to 15 or whatever, right, the coach doesn't really want to be around somebody that's not a good person. Because there's somebody probably just as good as you or close to as good as you that you can play with that probably aren't going to play anyway, right, at that point.
There's a lot of guys I know that I'm friends with that had 9 or 10 year careers that never played more than 10, 11 minutes in a game, never were really an 82-game regular rotation player, but they were great fucking dudes.
Yep.
And they lasted 9 or 10 years and maximized their career because of this very thing we're talking about.
And if you get that 10th year, you get that pension.
You get that pension, you get that health care.
You get that health care, you get that.
Lifetime.
Yeah.
The influence of the game in the NBA, European basketball, on the college game. We maybe had talked about this, and we haven't really like dove into this. It feels like at times when I watch college, there's a big difference between coaches who have embraced what I would call modern basketball concepts versus what I would call antiquated basketball concepts. Where is college basketball right now with being influenced by either the NBA or EuroLeague or you know, World FIBA competitions, just in terms of X and O strategy?
So clearly, in my mind, the NBA has been influenced by the European basketball. And I feel like college basketball is 2 to 3 years behind the NBA. And the reason I say that is, for instance, when people started icing the ball screens, that took 2 years before it hit college basketball. And then everybody, to offset the ice, they started going to the elbow handoffs, right, the dribble handoffs. And that took another 2 years before it hit college basketball. So the last thing probably that occurs is the ISOs and finding the elephant in the room, I call it. You know, the guy that can't really
target
guard.
Hunting.
Yeah,
target
like hunting. LeBron was talking about pointing it. We're going at him. Yeah. That's probably the last thing. And the one thing that's different is there's not as many great players in college basketball as there is in the NBA. So it's never going to look exactly the same. But I think the NBA has clearly been ahead of college basketball and will remain to be the driving force of college basketball. It takes coaches a long time to adjust. Like probably when you played some, there was still some motion offense, right? You don't see hardly any of that anymore. Like we used to cover like down screens, back screens, low crosses. Now what we do is we cover ball screens and dribble handoffs and split screens, you know, like you were talking about. That's all we cover.
NC State was the only team in my 4 years in college, and that was later on after Herb Sendek had left, I believe, that iced a pick and roll. Boston College still ran flex when they joined the ACC. Your boy Duds. They literally just ran the flex offense.
Al Skinner, right?
And that's all they ran. Yeah. So, yeah, I get the difference between, or the I should say being behind on things. The one thing I have noticed, particularly this spring in March Madness, is there are some really good coaches that are being creative with non-shooting players, non-spacing players. So the difference, of course, between the NBA and FIBA in college is that you can be in the paint, right? And there are certain players, it's not like the NBA. The NBA is the best of the best. Great college team might have 2 or 3 NBA guys. Of those 2 or 3 guys, maybe one guy has a 10-year career, right? That's just the reality. So there's going to be players on the floor that you don't have to guard. And UConn does this with Danny Hurley. I saw the Baylor women's team do this at the end of a game on a need three situation, is you use the non-shooter in the corner. You put the shooter either on the block or on the same side wing, skip pass, either uphill DHO, or a DHO to the person on the block. And Baylor used it to get a game tying three to send it into overtime.
Yeah, because then his man can't really help on those hands.
Exactly. So far away.
You have to, I think that's one thing, and I think the other thing is using your shooters as screeners more, you know, both on the ball and off the ball. Back screen, you know, into a down screen or back screen into a ball screen, just trying to get your shooter involved. But your idea is a really good one because they're always late. You were talking about being late to the handoff and the ball screen, the overreaction.
Yeah,
that's a good point.
When UConn runs that play with their big guy, there's constant overreaction. They get slips.
They get
threes.
I mean, you saw it last year. I mean, obviously they're doing it again this year, but Jordan Hawkins got so much action last year over that because they had a non-shooting big out there. Obviously Jordan Hawkins is being body to body, but X4, X5 does guard the non-shooter. He can't get back up the floor.
I just want to draw one play.
They're not used to being out there either. Right.
I'm sorry. I got to draw.
It's like a fish out the water.
Because I'm like a especially in college, where these people guarding non-shooters are literally standing.
I hate to bring it up, but Illinois went 55 real minutes without scoring a point versus UConn.
UVA had 14 in the first half and went like, I don't know, close to an hour, 43 minutes without scoring an actual point.
Yeah, it was insane.
Cheers, coach. Man.
Cheers, man. Cheers. Cheers, man. Good seeing
you. All right, so like if a team is top blocking a shooter over here, let's say this is fluff.
Yep.
This is fluff. This is like the four man going to screen. You've got your five over here.
Yep.
This guy's pulled all the way. This is where the ball is.
This
right
is college.
This is what I'm talking about.
Yep.
You set this up with the away screen. This defender jumps into a top lock.
Yep.
This guy is just sitting in the paint. You skip past it to the corner.
Yep.
Here's the uphill DHO. Yep. Now this guy's going to be late.
Yep.
This guy's out of position because he thinks this is coming.
Yep.
There are ways to get around the spacing issues in college.
And the same thing he was saying, if I'm being top locked, right, and the big comes sets the pick and roll, or sets the wide pin, if I'm the guy that's being top locked, I'm the shooter, I can go underneath, snake it, and set the ball screen on the ball handler. Now my guy's top locked. He can't switch. He can't help. Now the ball handler comes off naked.
Yeah.
Because my guy's only worried about me coming off to get a shot.
I used to do that with Joel.
Yeah.
Remember our elbow two action?
Yeah, absolutely.
Left elbow, I'm in left corner. And a lot of teams would top lock it.
Yeah.
And I would literally just walk my guy up into Joel's man.
You screen two guys at once.
Joel would spin, he'd get a layup.
Yeah, you screen two guys at once. Yeah.
That's absolutely great stuff. Coach, before we let you go, and thanks for being our first guest. Well,
thanks for having me.
I got a question for you. And I'll ask LeBron this in 2 or 7 years, we're not really sure. What are you going to miss the most about the game of basketball and about being around it every day?
I just think the effect you have on people. You know, I think one of the things that I always tried to teach LeBron was you're going to hit some rough moments, but you got to battle through. I think that's the biggest thing is these young people need advice as to how to handle adversity, because what happens a lot of times is they get bailed out of adversity now. Nobody really teaches them what to do when they hit it. Because we've all been there, right? We've all been in some tough situations. Just when you think things are going great, something happens. And if you don't know how to handle it, it's really difficult.
Yeah, that's great. All right, cheers, guys.
Cheers.
Coach, appreciate it.
Thank you.
Appreciate you.
Cheers.
We're good.
He's high.
Because he's so high.
Single side and high.
And you put the one here because if the one or the two decides to help on a lob, they're too small.
Hey guys, thanks for listening. Thanks for watching Mind the Game podcast. If you like it, please hit that subscribe button. Thank you.